simply and at all costs from that kind of consciousness. There's also such a thing as a good consciousness, healing, a spiritual consciousness. And with every opportunity that you have, immerse yourself in such a consciousness. Place yourself there because it will perform its magic in your mind and in your life. And in the power of such a consciousness where two or more of you are gathered together in my name, saith the Lord, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, Christ, God, there am I also. And if you and I will insert ourselves expectantly into such a powerful consciousness, that presence will speak. Not only will it speak, it will heal you, it will change you, it will very personally reveal itself to you in the ways that are important and necessary to you at the moment. And tonight it is the consciousness that will speak to you. The words that you hear will have some value, but a minimal value. It is the consciousness of God as you understand God that you invite to come into your own mind, body, and affairs. Do that now. Become a channel and know that all is well with you. You have a feeling? I have a feeling. All through history, mankind has felt intuitively that there is a way out. If only we could find it. You feel that. That's why you're here. You're looking for a way out and up into another dimension of life that you know exists. All of the old fairy tales tell again and again that story. Remember that Aladdin had a wonderful lamp and he rubbed it and received the things that he wanted? And that lamp was the creative activity of his own mind. He was able to speak the word, to rub his own mind, and instantly there appeared into his life that which he wanted and needed. Remember Cinderella in the kitchen, miserable and unhappy like so many others? There may be even a Cinderella or two here with us this evening. You think you're trapped in the kitchen of your life, destined to live at that level always. But then something happened to Cinderella. A pumpkin turned into a carriage and a pair of white rats turned into white horses. And you know the rest of the story that happened to Cinderella. And when you were a child and heard this, did you not wish that it could happen to you? It can. But don't you imagine that there must have been a change in Cinderella's consciousness first? And there was. Go back and read the story. And always men and women like you and I have felt intuitively that there was a way out of the dilemma of their experience, out of the kitchen of their lives. That it's not necessary to be angry and mean and resentful and bitter. That it's not necessary that a man should fight and grab for prosperity and for food. What is life really worth if living is a constant struggle? Remember the story of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, and he couldn't bear to be like the other gulls, fighting and scrabbling for garbage. He knew there was a way out of that experience which was normal for the flock. Men and women, and even a few seagulls, have always known intuitively that there's a way out. If only they could find it. You can't. Because it has always been seeking to reveal itself to you. You see, we've always known that God means for our lives to be noble and creative and joyous. You know that. But you've also come to know that before any outer change can occur, there must be a change in your consciousness. Not just on the surface, because most of us have lived on the surface of our lives. But down deep where you really live, down in the very heart of your own being. And before anything can change in your life, your state of consciousness must change. You see, all trouble, all disappointment, all depression, all limitation is merely a state of consciousness that must be changed. The limitation that has existed in your life, the smallness, the narrowness of your existence, the very prison walls that you've built around yourself are your own consciousness that can be changed. And to try to force an outer change before something is changed within is to be defeated even before one begins. It simply cannot be done. In these first four lessons of our journey toward higher consciousness, we have taken some giant steps by the use of these spiritual laws to change our minds, to change our minds about ourselves, the nature of life, of God, and of the universe, and to begin to fulfill the conditions for a new experience in our lives. You see, in the universe, nothing is free. And everything that you want must come because the condition for that thing is fulfilled first in your own consciousness. You and I can never cheat nature or life. You can drag into your life by willpower certain things that you know that do not belong to you, but you can only keep them for a short time, because the moment you take your hands off them, the hands of your mind, they fly away. Now, consciousness is merely another modern and more acceptable word for soul. Your state of consciousness is your soul state. It's the conditioned state of your subconscious mind. There's nothing sacred about the soul, small S-O-U-L. That's a changing, vacillating, conditioned or program level that is also sometimes referred to as our conscience. Remember, let your conscience be your guide. Don't you dare. Don't you dare let your conscience be your guide, because it can only lead to trouble. You see, most of the information that we've programmed into this level of our minds is either completely wrong or, at best, only partially right. And it cannot guide us where we want to go. It's not the way out. It's not going to take us upward and onward into that destiny that has been created for us. You and I want to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of a power, an intelligent power that's greater than ourselves, right? Not our conscience. We must change our conscience. Now, the way out of our dilemma lies in the spoken word. In the Bible, word means any definitely formulated thought. Now, not just the drifting thoughts that float through your mind. Now, the word is the creative expression or activity of your own mind, and the strongest and most creative word that you and I can speak is, I am. Whenever you and I have said in our lives, I am, then we've been calling upon the universe to do something for us, and it did. You see, your life is what you've called for, and it has been delivered to you. Now, if you were like I have been, you did not know what you were doing when you were calling for these things from life. You said, I'm tired, I'm sick, I'm poor, I'm afraid, I'm angry, I don't like this and I don't like that, and eventually there wasn't very much left to like. I'm disappointed, I'm fed up. And we have drawn, as the result of this, future trouble and limitation into our experience, except that future has become our present moment, our present life. Now, remember that you don't have to use the actual grammatical form, I am. You don't have to say the words every time. Because every time you associate yourself in in thought with anything or think of yourself as having anything, you're using a form of I am that instantly goes into expression. And I have means the same thing as I am. Whatever you and I associate with, that thing we're bringing into our consciousness. So, can you begin to see how over the years of our lives we have programmed into our minds ideas that are actually power concepts, invisible patterns that act upon the power of the mind? And by the word that you speak, by what you believe, coupled with the feeling that you have had moment by moment as your experiences have unfolded, look back and you will see how you have put thought and feeling together moment by moment, reacting to the many situations of your life, and as a result you have formed a giant living image inside yourself of what you really believe in your heart or subconscious mind that life is and that you are. And this image, or I am edge, it's no coincidence that it's even spelled the same way. Image means I amage. Becomes and continues to be what you call your life. It's your image of yourself. And your outer experiences will be nothing more or nothing less than this inner state and this inner programming that you would call my conscience, my consciousness. So your unconscious mind, or to use a better term, subjective mind, is like a giant living computer. And whatever ideas that we have programmed into this computer will remain there forever or until they have been programmed out again. Now, not only are these ideas in our subjective minds, they are alive in there. And they're very active. They control your whole outer experience constantly, moment by moment. Not only do they shape your moods, your attitudes, and your reaction to every person, every event, every experience, but these hidden concepts actually draw into your experience the kind of persons and events that become your experience. For example, have you known a very angry person, someone that loses their temper easily, and they're always drawing to themselves the very conditions that they need to lose their temper? Have you noticed that in your life? Or someone that's afraid of certain things, and the certain things that they're afraid of are always appearing in their life. You see, these concepts draw to them their equivalent, the experience. Now, in the 12 steps that we're working with, we found a way to change our minds, to alter or to rearrange our consciousness and thereby change our lives. And in these 12 steps to a spiritual experience, we're being led along a way that goes contrary to our normal designs. Some of you have probably already found to take these steps means a deflation of the ego. Not only does it mean that we have to begin to go against much of what we have already learned and have fiercely defended in the past because we have believed that our ideas were real and valid and true, but also you will find yourself instinctively recoiling or rebelling at taking what appears to be great risks as you move into these steps. You see, we would like to find an easier, softer way. Oh, we would just love to have our good happen to us, wouldn't we? But it doesn't. This fifth step into our journey into higher consciousness is a dramatic example of what I'm talking about, as you will see when you begin to practice it. Admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, or exactly what we have discovered about our lives. This goes against our instincts because instinctively we have covered up our errors, our mistakes, our shortcomings, our defects of character. The actions of our instincts run wild. For the most part, it's been all right to do almost anything, just don't get caught. It's what our instincts say. And if you do get caught, don't get caught. Lie about it. Or hide it or conceal it. And not only have we hidden from the world these things that bother us and burn us, but even from ourselves have our minds tried to blur and blot out very important areas of our living experience. You see, certain distressing or humiliating memories, we've told ourselves, ought never to be shared with anyone, and these things will remain our secret, and we hope they'll go to the grave with us. This is an instinctive, protective, reflex action of the mind. And when it happens, it's usually confirmed by the intellect that examines the experience and nods its head and says yes, and there makes a deep resolve that it will bury any and all unpleasant facts about itself from itself. It will look away out from itself. Now, in the light of truth, we learn that this is not only a dangerous resolve, but a perilous and foolish course of action that has caused many, many damaging experiences to come into our lives. You see, the things that we try to bury end up burying us, or very nearly so. And certainly, they will mean the death of our spiritual identity and our peace of mind, our joy, or any hope of demonstrating the good life in this life. The thing that on this earth we pay most dearly for is the lack of understanding of the nature of how our minds work. How to practice principles in all of our affairs. And in one important area of not understanding, the failure to clean the house of our minds is the basis of almost all of the diseases that exist in the world. The people that you know, and with yourself. And I don't mean just diseases of the body. I mean the discomforts that we feel inside ourselves, the tension and the trauma, the irritability, the inability to function well. You know what I'm talking about because you've felt it today. At some time during this day, you have felt a dis-ease, a lack of harmony and unity within yourself, and you couldn't quite put your finger on it. Now, many people who have recovered through the application of these principles will tell you how much they have suffered, not knowing at the time where the source of their irritability or anxiety or remorse or depression was really coming from. And how, going through this experience, they would sometimes accuse even their best friends or the people that they loved the most of the very character defects that they were trying to conceal from themselves. As a matter of fact, this week, since last week's inventory, someone came to me and said this was a pattern that she has discovered in her life and never saw it before. How very carefully she has pointed the finger of her mind at certain conditions that were latent within herself, and now she sees it and has a chance to do something about it. And so we discover that relief never comes by confessing the sins of other people. Everybody has to confess his own. And the practice of admitting one's defects to another person is a very ancient practice. And it characterizes the lives of every spiritually centered and truly religious person, and certainly every great spiritual leader that has ever lived. Those people just don't hide anything. And as they move through the experiences of their lives, they pause along the way and stop and repair the things that need repair. Today, not only does religion, but psychiatry and psychology as well point out the deep need that every one of us has for the practical knowledge and insight of our own personality traits and flaws, as well as for a deep discussion of these insights with an understanding and trustworthy person. Let me read to you some of the statements out of the past about this insight. Joshua, the 7th chapter, the 19th through the 21st verses. Joshua said to Achan, My son, give glory to the God of Israel and make your confession. Tell me what you have done. And Achan replied, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. For I saw a beautiful robe imported from Babylon and some silver worth $200 and a bar of gold worth $500. I wanted them so much that I took them. And they're hidden in the ground beneath my tent with the silver buried deeper than the rest. And they had a little experience after that, after Achan told Joshua. You can read about it if you like. The 32nd Psalm, the first through the sixth verse. What happiness for those whose guilt has been forgiven. What joys when sins are covered over. What relief for those who have confessed their sins and God has cleared their record. Sins. If there was ever a word that I did not like, it was that one. Sins. And all that it really means is to miss the mark, to fall short of the goal. And we do this every day. We fall short of our capacity to function well in life. And when you do that, you have merely sinned. That's all. It's a very natural experience. But notice tomorrow when you go out into your life, when you make a mistake, it can be a mistake in grammar or the pronunciation of a word. Simple little thing. And notice instinctively the tendency to cover it up, or if you can't cover it up, to explain it away. Notice how quickly you will jump in with an explanation of how and why that thing happened rather than saying, I did it. Oh, the feeling that comes when you say, I did it. When you stop trying to be perfect before you are. Oh, it feels so good. There was a time, the psalmist said, when I wouldn't admit what a sinner I was. But my dishonesty made me miserable and filled my days with frustration. Sound familiar? All day and all night your hand was heavy on me, O God. My strength evaporated like water on a sunny day until I finally admitted all my sins to you and stopped trying to hide them. I said to myself, I will confess them to the Lord, and you forgave me. All my sin is gone. Now I say that each believer should confess his sins to God when he's aware of them, while there is time to be forgiven. Judgment will not touch him if he does. Matthew, the 3rd chapter, the 6th verse. And when they confess their sins, he baptized them in the Jordan River. When they confess their sins, they entered into a higher experience in consciousness. That's what baptism really means. It doesn't mean getting dunked with water. It means an experience in consciousness. James, the 5th chapter, the 16th verse. Admit your faults to one another and pray for each other so that you may be healed. The earnest prayer of a righteous man has great power and wonderful results. Righteous does not mean good. It means one who uses his mind in a right way. The right useness of one's beingness. 1 John, 1st chapter, the 8th through the 10th verses. If we say that we have no sin, we're only fooling ourselves and refusing to accept the truth. But if we confess our sins to him, he can be depended upon to forgive us and to cleanse us from every wrong. And it's perfectly proper for God to do this for us. Wow, isn't that, doesn't that sound great? It does to me. It makes me feel good just to think about it. If we stop covering up and begin to observe ourselves and begin to watch ourselves in action as we go along. Now, God's timing matters is absolutely divine. Last Wednesday night here, this class, we studied the fourth step, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, or an honest examination of our mind. When class was over, and I was still standing here in the sanctuary, I was handed a message, and it was an urgent call from a distant city, from a very dear lady who's been in my prayer consciousness for several weeks. She's in a hospital there receiving radium transplants for cancer. And incidentally, she has the first known case in medical history of a person, of a woman, to develop endometrial cancer after the adrenals have been removed. And I mention this not because you need to technically know what that means. But because her case is extreme interest and activity in the medical center in which she now is, the doctors there consider it to be an unusual case, to say the least. I immediately went to the telephone and called my friend, and the conversation did not go as I had expected. It took quite a different turn. I had thought that I would talk with her and comfort her, and as I had some days before, and we'd have a moment of meditation and prayer, and that didn't happen at all. Before I go further into the story, let me tell you that I have her permission to share this experience with you. It's really your experience. And that as I do, you will hold her tightly in your love and in your prayers. You don't need to know her name. God knows it. And prepare to be shocked somewhat as I tell you the story. Remember that we live in a world where unpleasant things do occur. But there's a tendency for many of us to walk through life with blinders, to not see what's happening in the world, even those things that are happening to ourselves. Now, in May, I did a retreat in Texas on these very 12 steps, and this dear lady was there and appeared to be in good health at that time. And since then, this condition has suddenly come upon her, and we've talked over the telephone many times. And not only that, but she's been working with the 12 steps, using the application also, as outlined in this booklet, New Hope for Cancer Victims, by Dr. William Donald Kelly from Grapevine, Texas. That variation is in this folder that has been given you also. At any rate, she told me that, as I began to talk to her, that she was experiencing what to her was a revelation. Insights. Deep understanding was beginning to flow into her mind, and she needed to share it with me, and so she had called, and there was a feeling of joy, of electricity in this conversation, not like anything I had heard coming from her in the past. First, she said, she had recently recalled a memory of having heard or having read that cancer was caused by resentment. And her immediate reaction to this was that it wasn't true. But that if it was true, it certainly didn't apply to her. Had she not been a sweet, loving, nice little lady, kind to everybody all of her life, and never resented a soul? Ever. Never had a resentment. And she said, then at that moment, like a floodgate opening, a story began to unfold itself, a story that she had buried in terror inside herself. And instantly she went back to the summer when she was 13 and recalled that her mother had sent her daily to their minister's home to clean and do housework and maybe a little cooking for him each day while his family was in Europe. And each day while she was there, in her 13th summer, this man had violated her sexually. She was hurt and frightened and horrified, and most of all, she had a deep, deep sense of guilt, and she was even more frightened to go home and tell her parents. She was afraid of their reaction. So each night she lay awake, and each day she trudged back into this experience. It happened again and again. She felt ruined forever, that she could never be a whole person or a wife or a mother. So she blocked it out of her mind. Forever, she thought, no one would ever know. Then, in a short time, she did not even remember. And she said she saw this, and it was like something that she had never seen before. And instantly, she saw why her marriage of 25 years had been terminated. She had suffered anguish over this marriage because everything had been right in the marriage except the poor sexual relationship that had not been her husband's fault. And she said she had never been able to see this or to admit why the marriage had broken down. She said, in that 13th summer of my life, I had blocked sex out of my life forever. That I had decided in shame and hurt and anger that I was not worthy of ever being any man's wife. And I really have never been, even to my husband. And she said it didn't stop there, this unfolding, this revelation. With a real shock, she saw that all of her life she had been filled with a deep resentment that bordered on hatred toward her femininity. She had hated being a woman, had never wanted to be a woman, and had tried desperately to not be one. And this had counted for her weight problem, for the way she dressed and kept or failed to keep her hair, the lack of pride in many, many things. She said, 100 things flashed into my mind at the same time, and I saw them all simultaneously and understood how this hidden, seething inferno of a reaction had shaped my whole life to this very moment. And she said, instantly, she understood that this unusual cancer, only one of a kind as far as the medical profession knows, had struck and was trying to consume her sexual organs of reproduction, and that it was the result of holding inside herself the guilt and animosity of the past, because she had hated and hated and hated and could not look at it. She said there was instantly, as these things unfolded in my mind, a freeing like nothing that she had ever experienced, and the burden of a lifetime fell away, and she lay there in a hospital bed sobbing and sobbing and sobbing with joy, and still was when I called her. She said even then she knew this was not enough, that she had called me because she knew and was told inside herself that she had to share with another human being what was happening to her. And so in the midst of a beautifully moving spiritual experience, she had called here. The very same hour we were talking about how to take an inventory, how to begin to look at ourselves. And I told her what we were doing, and we were involved in these same steps. And she said, "Oh, Jack, please use my experience." She said, "Maybe it will help one of your people to have the courage to take a good, honest look at their lives, something I could never do, and not make the mistakes that ruined my life." Well, her life isn't ruined. You know that, and I. As a matter of fact, I called her today. She's doing just great. I think she's floating about 5 feet off that hospital bed. Here is a woman now in a condition that most people being in would be filled with fear, the fear of death, and she is living there with the joy of life, because of a revelation. Another person this week discovered a lifelong pattern of a deep-seated fear of being alone, not alone in a room or in an automobile riding down the road, but alone in life, alone with no family or husband or friends or so forth. And her mind went back and she saw that when her father made his transition when she was quite small, and then her mother had reacted to that in the very same way, the fear of being alone, of not being able to pay the bills, of not being able to fulfill the responsibility, and that had impressed the mind of this little girl. And then her mother died, and she was really alone. And the little girl lived on inside. But now she can change her life because her consciousness has changed. Someone else, a very, very honest person who dislikes people who lie. Have you ever disliked people who lie? Well, this person discovered that most of her life, her pattern has been to live a lie, to tell the truth about all outer things, but to never face the truth, to protect oneself at all costs so that others will not find out what really is going on inside the walls of the home or inside one's own being. Her life has been, in part, a lie. Another member of our class last week had the opportunity to return to her hometown and visit with a number of members of her family gathered there. And in the light of this step and these steps, she quietly listened to their conversation, hearing the old stories that she was familiar with, the things in the past, and hearing them now in a different way. And the past fell away from her because some of the things that she had thought were quite bad were not at all, and some of the things she had thought quite good were not at all. They just were. Life just is. You see, life is not bad. It's our reaction to it that has been so bad. It has been our reaction, the word that we have spoken, the thought and the feeling moment by moment that we have buried inside ourselves. It's patterns, ideas that live on in the form of a little girl or a little boy who still acts out that role. She said coming back to Detroit, she couldn't tell whether they drove or floated 10 feet off the ground. She's at peace, and I wish you could have seen the expression on her face. A man called me who was an alcoholic. Been sober for 8 years, drawn. He said, but I've been drunk for 8 years in my mind. I've not changed one thing. I have stopped drinking, but I still am acting out the same personality defects that I had before, and I could not see it until I began to look within myself, to observe myself. What have you seen? What have you started to see about yourself? Have there been any patterns? Have you had a glimpse, a flash, a revelation of some kind? Where are you in your unfolding fourth-step inventory? Perhaps you, like me, you haven't finished it yet, and that's all right. Keep working. Go back to it with renewed enthusiasm, knowing that this principle, coupled with the other principles, has the power to change your life dramatically in a fantastic way. You see, we have, by the thoughts we have thought, feelings that we have felt, we have programmed the computer of our consciousness. Those ideas are there, those impressions are there. We may not think they're important, but they are. And the willingness to go back, the ability to take oneself by the back of the neck and the seat of the pants, so to speak, and say, I am going to examine myself. Now, that of itself is not enough. There will be other steps that follow, but first we must see. I've never known anyone that could correct a problem that they could not find. Now, as you prepare to take your fifth step, to admit to God, for yourself, and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs or of the things that you've discovered about your life, the first step with the fifth step is to begin to look for the correct person for you with whom you can take your fifth step. It can be a minister. A priest or a rabbi. A counselor, a friend. But it needs to be someone that understands what you are doing and why you are doing it and has a feeling for what you're doing. It also needs to be someone who is shock-proof. Don't just do it with some nice, dear little lady that's been around Unity for 15 or 20 years who understands life. No. You find someone that can handle this kind of personal rapport. Someone who will not be disturbed. Someone in whose mind you will not be reduced. Your relationship will not be altered in any way. You will know that. That'll give you the freedom to move forward joyfully. Now, having selected the person that you know you can share with, then feel free to